Morning, everyone. Welcome. This is an open Q&A session, okay? So I'm Sam Guckenheimer. I have with me leaders from four engineering groups in Microsoft, and we'll do introductions in just a minute. I'm going to spend a moment framing this. We have been on a move for the last three or so years toward one engineering system in Microsoft. This is a decision that literally comes from Satya and his reports, the senior leadership team, that we were going to reverse a practice we had for the previous couple decades of each division doing their own engineering thing, and we were going to invest in the best engineering. In fact, this morning, Satya had his monthly town hall for employees, and a large part of that town hall was a discussion from Windows and Devices Group, that, in other words, you know, the Windows OS engineering leader Gabe All, about Windows' move to get under VSTS, where 90% of Windows is now under VSTS. And that was a big subject at today's employee town hall. So I have with me some very experienced and energetic folks.
Okay. All right.
So from furthest to nearest, Tony Seeley from Windows and Devices, Jordan Edwards from Bing, Jen P, as we know her from Skype.
Okay.
Parrott works.
Jennifer Parrott and Mike Giffen from Azure. So I'm going to let each of them introduce themselves for a couple minutes, and then it will literally be open Q&A. The only rule, and you're allowed to ask anything about how we work, the only rule is please use one of these two microphones, because this is being recorded for Channel 9, and if you don't use the mic, it slows us down because we have to repeat the question, yada-da-da, okay? So feel free to queue up at the mics and get your questions ready. Let's start with introductions. Why don't we start with you, Tony?
Okay, good morning. My name is Tony Seeley. I've been at Microsoft for around 17 years. Prior to that, I was with Great Plains Software, based out of North Dakota. Yeah. And prior to that, I was in the British Armed Forces for 9 years and 58 days, the last 58 days being the best for sure. Within the Windows and Devices Group, or WDG, I'm the GPM for the Group Program Manager for the engineering system that owns source control. So we're responsible for the old Source Depot solution we used to have, and we've just migrated 3,500 engineers to a 270-gig repo in Git. Been in the job for 2 years, and the sole request when I took the job was get everybody on Git. So we have around 6,500 engineers in total. Around 2,000 of them are working in smaller repos, and we've got another 500 to get onto this very, very large repo, this 270-gig repo. So that's me.
Jordan?
Sure. So I'm Jordan Edwards. I'm a program manager on the AI and R engineering experiences team. So that means we work on the engineering systems for Bing, Cortana, and Microsoft Advertising. Inside of that space, I own the source control, build, and CI/CD experience that our engineers interact with on a daily basis. As far as what we build, we have around 10,000 cloud services today and a slew of mobile applications as well. As far as our size goes, we're running on over 1 million ACU. We generate tens of petabytes of telemetry on a daily basis, and we're receiving tens of thousands of queries every second. What are our biggest problem spaces we're working on solving? One of them is how to be better at data-driven experimentation. Another is how do we decompose some of our monolithic services into containerized microservices. And the third one is how do we foster a culture where it's easier to share code across organizational boundaries.
Jen.
All right, so I messed up Sam earlier, so I always introduce myself as Jen P. And so folks don't even know how to pronounce my last name, and I sometimes get twisted. Jennifer Parrott. I'm coming up on 25 years with Microsoft. So old woman river here. Let's see. I started actually in the last 5 years, actually in a role from Azure, working with Skype, helping them re-architect the original Skype consumer peer-to-peer architecture onto the cloud so that we could actually keep up with the billions of devices that we wanted to make sure Skype could run on. So we had to re-architect that. I'm really excited to say that that also included a transition to DevOps. It also included a transition to microservices, and that we also got an opportunity to push the heck out of Azure. So when we originally started, IaaS wasn't out. It was 20 minutes to deploy, and we need to actually educate all of our engineers on how to build on Azure and how to expect it to go away. So super high availability on real-time audio video, four nines, and then in a DevOps mode. Areas that I now own are still the microservices, Azure compliance and security, because our backend infra also now ships with Microsoft Teams and SFB, so it's our next generation calling that's built on Azure. I also own the service build validation deployment CI/CD pipeline and our client build and validation pipelines. And this includes our transition to VSTS and Git. And we still have a mixed mode where we actually do within our backend infra, we have literally multiple clouds. So we still have the original Skype consumer, what we call our DCs, that are our Linux Postgres solutions on our bare metal, this original Skype consumer. We have Azure, we have Azure Autopilot, and then we also have our Skype for Business infra running on bare metal GFS. And so a whole bunch of different things there.
You said you didn't prepare that.
I tried, and then I started scrambling, so I was worried I went too far.
No pressure, Mike.
This
Hi,
guy.
Guys. My name is Mike Kippen. I've been with Microsoft for only 12 years, and I am an engineering manager on the engineering pipeline team, and we are part of the Cloud Engineering Services org. And as you can tell, a lot of engineering involved in what we do. More or less, the engineering pipeline team, we have a goal, which is to get developer changes from their local environment into the cloud as quickly and efficiently as possible, but with the key difference of maintaining governance, security, and compliance to meet the Azure cloud requirements. We have to go in front of auditors on a regular basis, and we have, you know, a responsibility to our customers to meet certain goals of security and compliance, and really that pipeline is about stitching those things together so that developers have the right way to get into production without making mistakes. As part of this, we're part of the Cloud ES org, otherwise Cloud Engineering Services. This organization is a great place to work, by the way.
And
yeah, we are hiring.
Helping that, be clear.
And really, it's an organization that's designed about making cloud-first services to support, scale, and run the cloud. So this includes monitoring, diagnostics, logging, ICM, which is an incident management service, as well as performance management, and also the pipeline that I described. And when you look at Cloud ES as a whole, it's actually many of the products are used across all of Microsoft. ICM, for example, is used across all of Microsoft. And the scope has really grown from Azure and from the cloud to now being really, let's get this out to all of CNE, which is a major division at Microsoft called Cloud and Enterprise. And then let's take these things to all of Microsoft. And then if we can, let's also bring these things outside of Microsoft and make them first-party options. And things like Azure Advisor and some other things that you're seeing pop up really started from Cloud ES. Just to give you an idea of some of our scale, I did a quick query on just last week in terms of looking at what we do. And just last week, we had 35,000 pushes to our Git servers. Across that was from 5,000 developers across 1,200 repositories. And this resulted in about 9,000 official builds and 15,000 merge validation pull requests. So every single piece of code that hits a server, you need to make sure it doesn't contain credentials, it doesn't contain viruses, and that these things are verified that we're not breaking everybody else on different types of platforms. So we actually do validation on everything that hits a server. And the really positive note about this is just as the scale of the cloud's been going, we were able to do just last week 7,000 releases that went into the cloud. So it's a little bit about me. And my first time at Build, I've just got an opportunity to walk through the hub. Pretty exciting, and thanks for letting us be part of this. Yeah.
That's great. Okay, anyone want to start us, or I'll start us since no one's at the mic.
I see some folks walking to the mic.
Oh, right. Okay, you've got the first question.
Yeah. Thank you, sir, for breaking the ice.
So my question may be one that nobody else is asking because I'm sort of an old troglodyte, but I was in the NT kernel team for 20 years. I remember the transition from slime to Source Depot. Yeah. Everybody was excited about that because it was clear benefit. Yeah. I've seen the posters up at Microsoft about the five stages of grief moving to Git, and I've talked to a few folks still over there, and they're not sure what they're getting out of Git. So since I'm not a Git convert yet, what was the transition for Git? What was the benefits that you're seeing from it?
Yeah, I can answer that. So we actually did a lot of analysis. I joined the team, as I said, a couple of years ago, and we started off by doing a lot of analysis on the Source Depot system we had at the time. One of the big challenges we have is the number of engineers that we have accessing the system on a day-to-day basis. The amount of code that we actually have inside the multiple depots that we have. We had 65 different, for those that don't know, Source Depot is a centralized source control system where we have, it's so large for our needs, the amount of source that we hold, that we actually had around about 450 gigs worth of data across 65 different databases, which then you had to pair together, which we call depots. And the challenge would have numerous issues. First thing is that when you actually did check-in submissions into the Source Depot solution, you'd have to usually, or sometimes, save stuff to more than one depot at the same time. And frequently, we'd encounter tearing issues where you'd, you wouldn't have an atomic submission. You'd succeed in one, and you'd fail in another. The other big issues that we have with Source Depot is as we've grown, about 3 years ago, Windows was a much smaller organization. And we merged a number of teams together. We merged Windows, Windows Phone, Xbox, our analog team, now our Surface team is in there as well, our devices and hardware team is in there as well. And now you have all this stuff in one location. Source Depot was starting to fall over. And we spent a lot of time patching it and getting it working. So we did a lot of evaluation 2 years ago on what the alternative should be. Should we redouble down on Source Depot and make it better? We brought in some third-party vendors to offer solutions, which we evaluated. And we looked at Git in a big way because that was the bet that Microsoft was making with the One ES solution or the Visual Studio Team Services solution that's available. The big wins that we get with Git are, first and foremost, it really helps collaboration and experimentation. If you want to experiment on something in Source Depot, you basically have to back up all your changes if you haven't made a submission. You have to start again, or you could re-enlist, which is the clone alternative for SD. Well, actually doing an enlistment could take you 45 minutes. And so what had tended to happen was people wouldn't do the enlistment. They would try and work, and they'd mess up their old code when they were trying something new. Or if they're working on a feature and a bug would come along, it was very difficult to actually put that feature to one side, start working on the bug, and then go back to the feature afterwards. Or if they wanted to collaborate with somebody else and work on the same thing, it was just a horrible experience. Because creating a dedicated branch, because branches are all about how it works in SD, not so much in Git, it became a huge pain point. Now, with Git, branches are an astonishingly lightweight concept. In fact, branches are just a pointer into a huge graph tree. And so it's super, super easy to create branches. They take seconds to create. You can share those branches with anybody. You can invite people to work on those branches. You can be working on one thing, and then you can swap very quickly to a new branch to experiment or to work on more than one feature at the same time. The whole opportunity around collaboration and experimentation was just very, very different. Now, I'll tell you that we migrated 2,500 engineers in 1 weekend. Which is our whole one core, our centralized core engineering solution services in one go, which was a very scary thing for us to do because they are the kernel and the file system driver guys and the media guys that work very low level down in the system. They're all hardened Source Depot users that have been using the system for 17 years. And we really didn't know what sort of response we'd get. Well, we did a survey 2 weeks after the transition, and we got 72% of the organization were either somewhat or very satisfied with the transition, which blew us away. Our NSAT on people moving is very, very high. It's like 147, which is kind of unheard of for a transition of this size. We moved them on a Friday night. We actually opened up the branches for them to start using the system on the Sunday morning, which was just, again, an unbelievable achievement. There are other benefits as well. 70% of the world, the industry, uses Git. So when it comes to onboarding individuals and bringing them into the organization, it just is so much easier if they're using the same solution they used in college or in other companies. Mm-hmm. We are now starting to truly embrace open source within Microsoft. We are encouraging, it's a very different cultural Microsoft than it was 5 or 10 years ago. We're encouraging engineers to don't write something that's already out there. Go and get it from open source and incorporate it into your code. Obviously, there's lots of checks and balances when we do that, but we do that a lot. When the whole of the open source community is storing everything inside Git, if you want to get that and collaborate to it as well, return stuff to open source, if you're on the same system, integration becomes so much easier and sharing becomes so much easier. We have a number of partners we work with on a regular basis, a lot of silicon and OEM partners that we work with out of the Windows organization. None of them work in the source depot solution that we have. And so being able to integrate and collaborate with them in an effective way and share code more effectively, Git becomes significantly better. The challenges we have is how do we do this on a 270 gig repo, which incidentally is just so the largest in the world, it's beyond comprehension.
So, one thing to ask you there, I mean, you mentioned the poster, and it was about, just to tell the room, it's 5 stages of moving to Git. And it's got essentially these smiley faces that are very unhappy and very angry and red. And then over the course of the 5 stages, they become very happy and green. And it talks about this experience. And I think one of the things we've learned about Git is that you can't just tell a team, go use Git. They have to learn the processes of pull requests and dealing with how to create branches on their own. And despite all the documentation out there on the internet, it's a team in the way they operate. When they come from something like Source Depot and they try to just redo it in Git, they don't really get the benefit. So at least speaking to that in the Azure organization, it was we did a lot of brown bags and we did a lot of documentation, but it was trying to show people how to use it properly and lead by example that way. And then the team figures stuff out over time, but it's not necessarily a switch in awesome NSAT. We didn't really see that in Azure. And still today, we find teams still using Git like Source Depot. And it's you know, as you get more college students and stuff, you do see that it's getting better. But
well, it's funny experience. You mentioned that. Before we onboarded everybody, we actually went and interviewed a large number of teams. We interviewed people from Azure, a lot of teams that actually had made the transition. And they all talked about the same experience. They said, it was horrible for a while. It was just, I struggled and fought it every day. And then they all described this same thing. There's an epiphany and a eureka moment, a light bulb goes off, and they immediately get it. And then from that point on, things get substantially better. And the 5 stages of Git posters that we produced, which are really the 5 stages of grief, was a bit of a joke that we did just messing about internally. And someone created a poster from it, and it went viral. Everyone started posting these things up. But it's very accurate. And what we found is that I will tell you now, we have engineers that have been at Microsoft for 20-plus years that have used Source Depot for 17 years, and they are never going to leave the first stage of the 5 stages of Git. They are going to hate it for their entire time. And you know what? We trained over 4,500 people in big auditoriums, at 700, 800 people at a time, on a whole day course, providing them Git fundamentals, the deltas of the GVFS system, which is the mechanism by which we enable a 270 Git repo to clone in 2.5 minutes. We did all this, showed them everything. We have extensive wiki articles and documentation that we create. You're right, that's the only way to do this. We introduced a champions program where every team had a champion. Actually, most teams had more than one champion. And their job was to provide escalation and support and mentorship and coaching, act as the first line of support, if you like, for those individuals that are onboarding. And we are seeing that by far the majority of individuals are embracing it. But there are people that are never going to like it. And I feel bad for those guys, but we have to, if we're going to embrace collaboration and open source and code sharing, we need a better system than Source Depot.
So in case you're a little colorblind like me, this is what happy and green looks like.
Well, and I would add there's still, like, what's interesting, you know, there's still this movement. There's a lot of teams still on Source Depot. Some of the conversations, and just to kind of add some things that are still topics that we're trying to figure out, within my organization, we've done multiple Git repos. So we're going with this entire strategy around microservices, really focused on small teams, lots of little teeny tiny repos. And again, that's because we were starting from scratch with a lot of our re-architecture. So we could do that versus, hey, we're just trying to move some pieces out of a monolith into microservices. But what gets interesting there is now the conversations that we're having across Microsoft around, well, when do you want to use multiple Git repos, and when do you want one? And so one of the things that actually our organization had to solve is that for the Skype client, we actually have multiple repos that we do need to actually build at a single point in time, because it's like our core library that goes out with the device. And so we actually had to solve a solution across multiple Git repos to really literally say, okay, we're gonna build this all at once and set feature gates up associated with that pipeline. And now we're in discussions with a lot of teams where they're trying to kind of wrestle with that. And I think that's something that's gonna kind of ever evolve as we continue to learn more. Because it is this interesting range now, if you look at between the monolith and the microservices, and when and where you want, like, in some cases, almost a mini monolith, right? Like the core library stuff that goes on a client.
Jenny's right. If you can survive in small repos,
we're all Git. We got other people. So yeah.
That was the first question.
Yeah, I'm worried for these poor guys.
Okay. Okay. We have another one queued up here, and we're gonna. Let's keep going.
Yeah. He kind of took what I was going to ask, too, is how many people screamed when you took away TFVC and stuff like that.
I'm sorry,
that.
But, can you speak up, please?
Oh, yeah. He kind of took my question, was I was going to ask how many people screamed when you took away central source control.
Good.
But
yeah.
But you kind of got into that. So I helped manage a couple of TFS instances on-prem, an old 2013 one with a huge sprawl of TFVC, many yep. collections. You've probably seen this before. And as well as just a recently new setup TFS 2017 instance, and I also help co-administrate our VSTS instance. And in many ways, we're going through this same exercise right now, because I read things like Brian Harry's blog post about yep. the One Engineering System. So I guess my question is we get the same type of resistance at times from people. What would you advise organizations out there in the enterprise that are going through this type of transition right now, what kind of tips would you give those folks that are trying to move from TFVC over to Git into these new systems?
I can start with that one. I think that the most important thing is to accurately set expectations. We, as part of the engineering system in WDG, we've rolled out a few different technologies. Some have gone really, really badly, and some have gone really, really well. And the real differentiator between the two is that we oversold the ones that went badly. We believe the hype. You know, you do it when you're in your own team and you're passionate about what you're building and you're super excited and you say, and you can do anything. But the reality is, day one, you probably can't do anything. And a lot of people find that if you set the expectation here and you don't make it, then you're going to have very dissatisfied engineers. And if you can set the expectation at the right place and wherever it is, yeah. then and ideally beat it, exceed their expectations, you'd be amazed how willing. You know, people go, engineers don't like change. From my experience, that's not true. But engineers don't like being lied to or misled. I mean, who does, right? But I think that's the big message.
Well, and work by example. I think take a subset of products you want to work with, move them to Git, and then have them work as you expect a microservice to work, and then show the data. And then what you can do is go back to these other teams and say, hey, look how this is rocking, and look how happy this team is working. And I think for us, it's more or less, when you try to beat people over the head with a solution, they oftentimes get negative and they want to push back. And if you can show them why you want to use something and give them that sort of carrot, it becomes a very different conversation to have.
And it's also important to get viral adoption. So. Yeah. Not just the engineering systems team is presenting this, but you have the product teams who are your ear dog fooders who are showing it to their friends and colleagues, and they're the ones who encourage that cultural transition. So we just finished moving all of Bing over to Git. We were also on Source Depot, and we thought we could do it all in 3 months, but after 3 months, we only had a few of the really eager teams, mostly full of like college hires, new hires, who were pushing that culture on their own. But once we reached that point, us giving the talks wasn't being that effective, but once the product teams were giving the talks on how it changed their workflows, that's when it really took off.
And every single thing we try to do from sort of the Skype infra engineering systems, like we have this, you have to pilot it with multiple teams and then develop champions. And for us, we're in 8 regional locations, right? We are global, truly. And so it's not like, hey, we're in one center and we can bring a bunch of brown bags there. So we really pick our pilots, you know, and our teams who will work with us side by side. And then from there, they foster that site location education.
Cool, thanks.
Yeah. Over here.
Hi, I want to talk a little bit about moving from kind of your source code management on-prem up to the cloud, and particularly kind of the culture shift that had to happen there. So I work in a financial services company, and so while we're not, I would say we're probably on the spectrum of more risk averse, and so we have IP, we have code that would be, we consider kind of our crown jewels. And so there's a discomfort in kind of taking that outside of our firewall and moving it up to the cloud. I know Microsoft, you're moving more towards open sourcing a lot of your tools and your APIs, but you still have your own crown jewels, Windows and other things like that. So can you talk a little bit about the, I guess, kind of the, what you had to do to kind of shift the culture to get people more comfortable with moving things outside of, or if that was the case, or what story would you tell to companies that are discomfortable or uncomfortable with moving things outside of their own firewall up to the cloud?
So, did everybody hear that question okay?
So how do you get people comfortable with moving from on-prem to the cloud?
Okay,
and particularly in a highly regulated environment like financial services.
So in Azure, we've obviously got all these compliance requirements, and you know, the cloud itself obviously is a center of a huge amount of attack surface, right? And so as long as you can break apart your code from your certificates, secrets, and the real stuff that actually can cause problems. Microsoft, and especially Azure, has really embraced internal open source. And we've locked down the ability to contribute code via pull requests, make sure that we actually have every single code change go through a code review. Those kinds of things become inherent. And you can stitch up your release process so that you only release things that have gone through these types of processes beforehand. It does take a certain amount of trust in making sure your code doesn't have anything that you don't want to share, and ensuring that you move those pieces out into other systems. I mean, you don't want to store secrets in your source code. You don't want to have, you know, secure encryption stuff in there. But the rest of it, you really shouldn't be able to touch your production instance with. And Azure has some pretty unique things in our engineering system, in the sense that we are an engineering system that uses Azure, but we also build Azure. So what happens if Azure's down? So we also have invested in building synchronous tools that brings Git back on-premise and it synchronizes back, and also worked with bringing NuGet packages and packages on-premise so that, hey, there's a big problem going on and we can't access our engineering system that we built in the cloud. We now have a system that at any given time we can still build and we can still release. And we've worked with a couple of external teams to actually do something similar so they feel comfortable about getting into the cloud. And I'll tell you something interesting. I had one of the employees that works next to me the other day came over and said, hey, I need you to restart this VM you created for me. And we looked it up, and I created this VM in 2014 for this person in Azure. And they had not restarted it or had any problems with it since 2014. I think that organizations, even us, we had to get comfortable trusting this whole service. And it takes time. And more or less, if there's processes you can put in place to say, let's bring this thing on-prem because it makes us feel warm and fuzzy or it's comfortable, over time you'll find, hey, people start to trust it and they'll start to get a feeling of how to use it. And when you realize you have all this tremendous scale and performance, that carrot is really awesome. I mean, the simple fact that you can start to leverage elastic scale, your customers start to focus on that rather than, you know, these other pieces, which, you know, obviously secrets, don't check those in. That's a huge piece that we do. But that is an aspect in terms of Azure, how we got there. Yeah.
So from a Bing and Cortana point of view, all of our code is open for all of our FTEs to see, with the exception of some of our advertising algorithms, which are considered trade secrets. And one of the nice things about VSTS is that it gives us the ability to effectively tent or constrain some of our repos in our code base so that just no random person can take our ads algo and publish it on the internet, and then people can start gaming the system.
Yeah, that's an important
point. That's a good point, the tenting of certain things. Yeah.
You can't apply ACLs to parts of a repo. And so you either get access or you don't get access. So what we do is we have separate repos for those secret areas. that you know, like DRM and stuff like that, that only a subset of individuals can actually get access to. But I also you know, encourage your management team to understand the fact, who else is actually embracing the cloud? I'll tell you, Windows is a pretty big target, and we are entirely in the cloud. We have multinational countries coming after our source code, mm-hmm. yet we're there. So it's pretty secure, so you should be fine.
Thanks.
Over here.
Great. This question's kind of targeted to Mike a little bit. you mentioned something really interesting earlier in your introduction about some of the things you have to deal with from an organizational perspective in the cloud. Security, governance, audit, and all of that. I find myself working a lot with organizations that are requiring a lot of startups, have a very traditional, what I would call monolithic development process, and a strong-willed IT organization. What are some of the techniques that you might suggest to try and get people used to a security development lifecycle for the cloud when, you know, there's a lot of demand by the product teams for agility?
It's a great question. We have this concept internally called the pit of success. And you just hope people fall in it, and you're successful, right? I think one of the best things that we did was take some of the standards that we believe in around how to create a repository, how to set up branches, how to control how your source code gets into your branches, and make it a standardized process that people adopt like this. We have an automated onboarding experience where people can run a tool and they just run repo create. We went from, I think, 100 or 200 repos to 1,200 repos before we blinked an eye. And what we realized is that people really don't want to set these things up themselves. And as long as you make it easy to adopt these processes, governance can be handled in a way where people can see it transparently, right? It's kind of happening, but they don't realize it. I think once you give people too much control, and you're a team that says, hey, I've created a project for you in Visual Studio, and I've created a team, you guys go crazy. What are they going to do with it? They're going to create their repositories, give access to service accounts. They're going to create build definitions that run antivirus before they compile code. We see all of this, right? And so there's a set of processes we've had to do internally that really is about automated onboarding, taking them through this entire experience in a sort of governed workflow, and telling people, yeah, we understand you want to do stuff custom, but use this thing, and you'll find it really easy to adopt and really easy to use. And then you don't have to worry about these other things. They're kind of handled. I think that aspect of it is provide a little bit of control where it's needed, but try to own the process end to end. And then when you go in front of auditors, I mean, I'm in front of auditors what feels like every 3 weeks, and we also go in front of Scott Guthrie and others. They know when you're using our system that it meets these standards because we handle antivirus. We handle the way code signing works. We handle how the code gets into production. That's all a very tight engineered governance process, but you have this with a carrot, which is in order to onboard, click this button, you've got it. And I think making that easy is probably the best way to success that way.
Yeah. And it's especially important as we move towards microservices.
Yeah.
So we've been moving from the tens to hundreds to now thousands of services, which are most of them want to go in their own repo, and if we don't have these pipelines in place, they kind of spew all over the place.
You did mention monoliths, right?
Yeah.
But they're trying to get to Agile.
Tell you, this is a fun discussion in Azure because depending on who you talk to in Microsoft, it's almost a religious feeling about having code time dependency and being able to have all your code together and build time, you know if you're failing or not, as opposed to having a very small repository that just handles a microservice and you ship very quickly. I think that architecture in certain areas where you're dealing with the very core of Azure, you're dealing with drivers and you're dealing with hardware, it makes sense to be a monolith. You want to know that this driver and these dependencies, they work together. As you start to go up a layer on top of Azure and you start building these APIs, version your APIs, make your API a contract, and that aspect of it is where we're definitely embracing microservices like crazy. I mean, we probably have 40 repos now that are about, you know, 1,200 projects or larger, and the rest of the 2,000 plus repos which are in use are, you know, one to two services. And so in Azure, you kind of see it all, and we have to take support for both because they are both legitimate reasons. Yeah.
Another nice thing is you can actually apply policies to the code flow, which would do things like, depending upon your business and your business needs, you could do things like you could enforce code reviews with more than one individual if you wanted to do that to make sure that the right information is always being verified before it hits your repo.
I'll add one last thing, just especially as you're going from monolith to microservices, and I'm taking from your question sort of that worry about, well, how do I ensure that this is fully secure? One of the big, like, aha moments 4 years ago I had with our compliance officer, this is, we're shipping bits into O365, the whole thing, and they're like, how can you do this? You can't do this. I literally asked, how many people on your ops team have exposure to this code?
What's an ops team?
Again, we were transitioning from dev plus ops to a DevOps role. And as soon as I explained that the size of our microservice teams running in DevOps were less than 10 people, many times actually five to six, and I said, now you have 200 ops guys and gals that are, they have access, they have full access. Here's who I have. And then we started talking through, like, well, what is the value of a cab review, right? These monthly, like, do they really know? Are they the ones that are gonna know? Or instead, do you get that accountability at that tinier team? So I'll just, hopefully that adds some value as well.
Thank you. Great, over here.
Yeah, sorry, we went through the whole journey.
That's good.
We've got about 600 developers in our company, and all the teams have varying degrees of CD maturity experience. My teams have a higher level of experience there. We're deploying multiple times a week, in most cases, to production. But we're trying to bring the rest of the enterprise into that. A lot of our success has been in kind of standardizing the CD pipeline and providing all the tools that they would need to do that. But now we're trying to work with many teams that have different types of applications, some monoliths, some microservices.
Yes.
And it's tough to balance standardized and in an efficient way of saying, here's these tools you can use versus the team saying, well, that's not how we do things, and we need to do these other things. And we don't have the bandwidth to do everything they need. So how do you strike a balance between providing standardized tools and allowing the teams to build their own and make progress that way?
Well, containers. Should I talk about what we're doing or coming?
Yeah, go ahead.
No, it's all containers. Yeah.
All right.
We have this problem today.
We do.
Microsoft is embracing OSS at a huge rate. I mean, we're getting more requests to support OSS than we are for Windows, in many cases in Azure. And when you look internally, Microsoft typically been built on Microsoft types of systems. And our team is investing heavily in bringing Docker containers and container types of systems into the engineering pipeline, because once you can say, you can build in a container, and I know that you got your source code from a compliant place, and I know you got your packages from a compliant place, do you really care how they build? Do you care what tools they use to build? At this point, if you basically try to tell a team, this is how you have to work, and these are the tools you have to do, you're always losing. That's at least what we've learned, is even across Azure, we have so many different types of architectures, from iOS to Android to Scala, and they want to use IoT. These are all things that we have to support, and they want to pick what they want to use. So what we're trying to do is actually find a way to isolate their environment when they do certain things, and then bring the governance and security between those. For example, you give them a place to compile, and you know that that is a lockdown environment. They can do whatever they want in there. When you pull the binaries off of that Docker container, virus scan them, code sign them, run your SDL tools, upload them to the cloud, that's your compliance being handled without telling them how to build. And I think it's about structuring your pipeline in such a way that you allow them to handle certain pieces while maintaining governance over pieces you need. And that is something that I think we are working very hard with Visual Studio, with the rest of the company, because Azure's kind of been piloting a lot of these things, and we are trying to bring that across the organization and see if we can bring many of these things externally. But it is one of those things that we need to stitch together this whole thing, and it goes back to that pit of success again, allowing them to use what they want to use, but making sure that they have the right governance where it needs to be.
I think you've asked the toughest question for any company, and we have this too. It is, we were talking about this before this event. It is horribly difficult when everybody has organically over time built their own systems, built their own solutions, and then you come along and go, you've all got to throw all that away and you've got to work the same way. I can't tell you there is an easy solution to this. I would say that Everything you said, I 100% agree with. I think that if you really want to benefit from collaboration within your workforce, code sharing within your workforce, movement of people around your workforce, you've got to find some common ground. Yeah. And I think that the great thing about the 1ES model is that that can provide you with that common ground. And you can make it the common area as simple or as complex as you like. And there's also some very strong extensibility models within it. So you can add extra capabilities to forms or to your policies and processes. So you know, you maybe provide 80% of the common area, but you give teams that flexibility to do the extra 20% that meets their needs.
Yeah.
But it does require, this is the tough thing, some compromise. And I think the way to do it is to really sell the benefits, assuming those benefits are right for your organization. Right. If you want to pollinate and share and collaborate, then you have to do this. It's the only way forward.
What kind of benefits have you been describing to the teams of, hey, this is what you get when you use this standardized system?
So a few different things from a Bing point of view. Lower DRI costs. So if you're on a CI/CD pipeline, your DRIs don't need to be manually checking in any files and pushing out the bits themselves. The more frequently you ship, the less bugs you run into, because the things have hit production, you don't have 1,000 changes which are backed up inside of it. You also now get the experience where everybody's on the same pipeline, you have unified telemetry, and you can figure out when your upstream dependencies have actually shipped, so you can ship a new version of your product.
And I would add, absolutely critical, this has been totally critical for Skype, is the ability for time to mitigate decreases. So a critical thing is what we have built is literally our configuration service, so that you know we're rapidly deploying, we're watching near real-time monitoring, and we can literally see this thing and roll it back in less than 3 minutes.
Yeah, we don't have a concept of like pushing a hot fix build out. We'll either roll forward or do a quick config check and flip it back immediately.
We'll roll
get
back.
Get some data to
yeah,
back this
that's
up.
That's critical.
I'd say the number one thing you're going to benefit from is you will save money by doing this. Because you right now have different people in different teams building the same solution.
Yeah.
It's a complete waste of time.
Yeah.
You want to convince people, get the costs on that. Find out how many people have built a pre-check-in validation solution that's different, and they're maintaining it. Mm-hmm. If you can provide one, you're going to save the business money. You'll have people
right.
that spend more time
yeah.
doing what's important than building pipelines and tooling and infrastructure.
And I'll add, I mean, our leadership actually purposely kept us at very resource constrained. It helped us actually make sure that we had to really figure out how to build together,
that
leverage each other. That was actually a plan.
Otherwise, yeah,
I'm
every
now pushing back
product
a little on that plan, but it was a
release
plan.
Release people on it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't want to have a developer turn into a release manager.
I mean, I work in the engineering system team,
yeah.
so I go out and I interview all these different teams, these product teams,
managers.
And it's staggering how much time we waste on building the same thing.
Yeah.
And they all go, but I'm different. You're really not that different.
Explain me how. Yeah.
You're really not that different. So you've got to make sure that as people build their extensions, that they share those extensions so other people can you know, add to them or just say, hey, that's exactly what I want, or I want that, but a little bit different. Do a pull request, add functionality. Mm. You'll find that your team, if they start collaborating on tooling, they start collaborating on product.
Yeah, when we started the journey to get towards putting everything into VSTS for release management, we had probably 900 different PowerShell scripts I found. We're doing 95% the exact same thing for shipping bits out to Azure. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, all right. Over here.
So this is probably a softer skills question. But as we try to follow in like the 1ES type of approach and do more collaboration, there seems to be a tension developing between product management, understanding what we're going to ship, when we're going to ship it, and what are the engineers who are now cross-pollinating, what are they actually doing and want to do? How do you address that tension?
Well, I can speak to that tension very well.
We're the PM,
actually,
I think we can all talk to that one.
Yeah.
This is where I duck out.
For sure, in the last year and a half, and there's more things coming that will really resonate with you guys in the next 6 to 12 months that I can't go into, but we have had a very high pressure on feature development in the Skype organization, all up, across all of our products, right? Microsoft Teams is one great example that I can speak to. And trying to make sure that we were balancing, actually getting what we needed to do in terms of the engineering pipeline while at the same time, the team struggling with Microsoft Teams was very difficult. And literally the hardest part, and I would say in hindsight, what I wish we could have done better was to give a little bit more lead time onto the, here's what you need to do, here's why you need to do it, especially around the compliance security governance. The challenges we were in is that there's a different compliance set of requirements when you're building the product on Azure than for Azure itself and their engineers. So when we're building something for O365, we had a whole different set of auditors. We had to take all the tools that we could leverage from Azure, and then, you know, so we were trying to do these things at the same time. I don't know that there's any magic way to not, you know, reduce that tension, but I would say what I wish I could do is give more of a lead time to the organization, and then also really put it down to the value, right? For us, I could, you know, at a point, I got to a place where I could actually say, this is the amount of dollars this opens up. This is why this is critical.
Jen, could you just riff a little bit on how you've also been able to provide data to inform?
Yeah, actually, we're going to, yeah, that's great, because that, we were actually, so one of the big other pieces for the Skype organization was a transition to sort of the data-driven culture, and we started, again, 5+ years ago, but with that, it was around end-to-end telemetry. So with Skype, you've got your client and you've got your services, and how do you actually do not only near real time, but also the post-analysis? Because I forgot to mention in the intro, but also a big piece on Skype is our experimentation platform. So we do client experimentation, web experimentation, and service experimentation. And so it doesn't quite go to what you're saying, but it's a topic that we also wanted to make sure that we hit. I don't know where else to go, but I will say that I can give one fact. These guys were much better at bringing facts. Right now, we do 30 billion events per day across all, and that's just for our Azure services. Then we also have all of our client telemetry, and then all of that is going into our big back end, where we're then joining so that we can get that end-to-end view of what's happening. I can also talk offline, but I don't know that I have a magic pill for that feature product manager. And
there isn't one.
It's just a battle.
The reality is we're going through this as well. Microsoft is evolving, and this, you're talking about cultural change. And culture, for depending on your organizational size, takes time. And it's like the Titanic slowly moving away from an iceberg, you know what I mean? It's and we are, I think we're making good progress, but we've still got a journey to go. And I think it's about clear role and responsibility communication. Make sure people understand what their roles are and they collaborate well effectively. It's not like one person defining something and throwing it over a wall. It's a collaboration. And making sure that those are well understood, yeah. I think that's really important. But, you know, being data-driven, being customer-driven from a customer perspective, and being LiveSite focus-driven are three things that we are really trying to emphasize in Microsoft at the moment.
Yeah.
All right. Etienne, I think you were next.
Yes. So I'm actually intrigued because I've started using Git, a couple of years ago since we kind of got to that transition in 2012. But your organization, like Microsoft generally, was on the Product Depot software you were in, which was centralized.
Yep.
A lot of my customers are on TFS VC, which is centralized as well. And moving to a distributed world with Git, I've struggled with organizations that have branches where they have their whole application portfolio in one branch that they're actually, you know, branching and keeping together and everything, which was pretty much the pattern that we were telling people to do and use, like put everything in one branch, then do your other branch for whatever you're doing, feature branch or anything. But I struggle explaining to them that when you're going to Git, now you're going to have to do repos, which are, you had that big, huge branch that had 50 application in it. Now that becomes 50 repo, and or less, depending on if you want to put stuff together. How did Microsoft go through that transition of saying, how are we going from those monolithic, centralized repo to we're going to do 1,500, because I keep hearing you saying, you know, we have 50 of those or 1,200 of whatever. Like, how do you go about saying this goes together and this doesn't? That's the struggle to me when we're transitioning people from a centralized world, TFS VC or other, to a Git world where it's much smaller.
So if it's okay with you guys, I'll take a stab at this first, because we definitely have, most interestingly, we still have our monolith, right? We definitely still have that. We will have reasons that we will continue to have that. We also, and I'm coining this term, it's probably not accurate, but I want to say it's like a mini monolith, but it's, you know, like I mentioned, that client core library. I think what I'm starting to resonate on, I haven't had anyone verify that this is the accurate way to think about it, but for me, since I think about time to mitigate and rolling back, I think about when you want to have a Git repo and you want to bring things together, or when you have, okay, I'm going to have these five Git repos and that's going to be my build in time, it's about what are you versioning? What's going to be the thing and what's that scope when you're going to actually say, that's what I need to roll back to fix it?
It's the deployable artifact, yeah.
Well, it's a great way to, that's the right wording.
I have a slightly separate opinion on
that. This is where we're all figuring it out.
I think as developers write code, they get frustrated when they have to move between repos, and sharing between repos can be kind of a challenge.
Yeah.
So if you have a high touch between a common component and another component, and they're often changing, it makes sense to keep it together. So for us, there's a very good option out there around NuGet packages where you could have a repository produce some NuGet packages, publish it to a NuGet server or NPM, and consume it as an API.
Yep.
The second you have a team that is going from a monolith to 50 repos, and they're now realizing that they're touching that common component all the time, and that's affecting many others, 50 may not make sense.
Yeah.
5 may make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where it's very highly dependent on the type of product you're building. It's really highly dependent on how that organization is kind of working. There's not one size that fits all, and you have to embrace sort of that aspect, which is you're never going to get it down to a repo per component. But obviously, that's the holy grail.
That's what we're trying. Yeah.
And who makes those decisions?
The product team needs to.
Yeah.
The second that you try to tell a product team what to do here, they're going to push back.
Yep.
I think.
I would say.
So I get
when
that.
When you can have an architect
but
as well.
Who on the team, like? Because to me, it's like they're saying, okay, so we're going to split it up in 7 or 5.
And maybe they try 7.
And then they learn.
And then they figure this out and they say, okay, it actually made sense as 5.
You have to embrace the build, measure, learn culture here. Right. You're going to try something, you're going to measure the success, and then you're going to go back and change it.
And
the reality is we're still working on this. We're still build, measure, learning. And we will be for a while.
And no magic pill.
Right. And there is no magic pill.
Yeah.
Every team is different. Yeah. I like what Mike said. Absolutely, there's this sort of perception that, you know, full componentization is the panacea we want to go. It's the way you want to be. It's not always the case, because then you end up with, okay, we've got thousands of different repos and different deliverables, and then you're in versioning
hell.
Problems.
You're
in versioning hell.
Exactly.
So you've got to find that balance, and every team, every company is going to be slightly different. And you know what? You might not get it right first time. So you've got to try, and I'd encourage you to find some middle ground. No, rather than go to one extreme or the other, and then figure out where you want to make slight course adjustments.
Yeah, because Brian talked about you guys trying submodules and kind of backing out with the Git LF and all of that. Like, what's your thoughts on submodules and Git?
I'll talk to that. And
we use them too.
We regret in our organization not investing in submodules sooner.
Yep.
I think there's aspects to that would have helped a significant amount earlier on, and now we are starting to embrace it big time. Submodules are scary to a lot of people. It just seems, you know, you can get yourself in trouble there. But it does solve a lot of problems. It doesn't solve everything. You have to pick it for very specific types of things. Submodules, what we're looking for is a way to bootstrap the tool set within the repository, rather than saying, I'm pulling all this code together in one place. Because then how do you version your submodules? How do you bring them in together and make sure they don't have problems? At least when we own the tool set, and it's our objective to get that out in a compliant way, we can push submodule updates without worrying about breaking anybody.
Rather than needing to submit like 500 pull requests to every single repo and get those all accepted just to push the tool update?
Yeah.
And I'll come back to the earlier topic that Sam was sort of...
We got 5 minutes.
I know, but yeah. You'll see where it aligns to what you're saying. I think what is most critical here is that telemetry. And yeah. In particular, the thing that we're still trying to get better at is how do you see all the changes in your systems, especially when you start to take... I mean, the beauty of a monolith is you know what's in that release. If that release starts breaking, right? Now the problem is then how do you mitigate it fast, right? That really kills you. So, but then how do you then, across a very diverse system, see that? And I think that's one of the areas...
Positive, negatives both?
Yeah, and then add in experimentation yep. and configuration. And so what we're doing right now is we've got all of our telemetry and we're working rapidly on trying to join the telemetry for every change to production. So the change to something that rolls out, the change because there's an experiment happening, and configuration changes so that we can actually then tie all that together and see point in time changes. But boy, we're not there. And if anyone cracks that, like, we need it quick. So it's an interesting area.
Thank you, guys.
Okay, I want to squeeze two more in. You're next, sir.
All right, so there's so many pieces of continuous delivery, right?
Yep.
CI, automated deployments, automated testing. How do you know where to start? A lot of teams I see are just paralyzed not knowing where to start, and I think it's important to kind of focus and do one thing and get it working and then move to the next thing. Have you found any kind of universal order of things that seems to work, or is it really a team by team?
I think telemetry is the first thing. If you don't get the telemetry right, everything, all bets are off. I'm sorry. If you cannot measure it and you can't see what's actually happening in your system, you know, the quality for your customer, first and foremost, and I feel really, I don't know that I was the one that was in charge of making that decision, but I'm so glad that whoever was the smart one that made that decision, because we rely on that so heavily. Mm-hmm. Then I think it's that quality piece and making sure, okay, as we're deploying, we can change. That's again, because it's about the customer, right? You're doing microservices or you're doing anything that's a service, you've got to make sure that you're hitting that reliability number for your customer. From there, I think it depends on the product. For us, what became a very big priority was figuring out what we had to do within the pipeline to meet our compliance and security requirements, because we were going to be shipping as part of the O365 contracts. And it was going to be a long journey to get there. So that's for us. Others may have a different...
I'd also say that I'd encourage you to start at your weakest point in the pipe. So analyze where you are today with your tooling.
Smart.
And if you're doing something really well today, don't start there, because it's working really well. But it's right.
You won't get a change, yeah.
Yeah, go for the areas where you know that you have opportunity for growth and improvement.
Smart.
Then you start to get people buying into it and going, hey, this is so much better. Then it's easier to go and change the one that everyone loves, right? So I don't suggest that. Let's be different.
Look for the low-hanging fruit.
In a more technical way, if you can own the entry point of where the pull request starts into the continuous delivery and add value over time, I think the aspect of allowing people to at least use build and validate the pull request and at least go through that, your value is going to change over time. And if you're a governed type of organization, you may be using a totally different test system in 12 months. You may be using a totally different release system. But having that entry point of access and being able to then stitch these things together is really the critical piece. If you allow everybody to create their own entry point and define how they start this thing, then you have no control on making it better.
So that was one of the major problems we had when we took over our previous deployment orchestration technology is you could provide bits from anywhere. We had no clue where they came from, how they were built, et cetera. So rather than trying to say, we'll just take this thing and lift and shift it into VSTS, we said, no, you must move your, like start at the beginning, move your pull request and CI pipeline first so that we have a central inventory of all of the build artifacts. And then from there, we can start unifying the continuous
start from your developer and work your way through.
Start as early as possible and go right.
Well, one more point I'll make.
I'm going to cut you off. Last question to the gentleman over here.
Such a good point.
Those are really good.
How do you validate the quality of new commits?
Can you speak up, please?
How do you validate the quality of new commits? What kind of tests are you running? Static code analysis? Those kind of stuff.
Data.
Sure, turn that off.
What are the things we do to evaluate the quality of the code in the pipeline?
Yeah.
Who wants that? Mike?
So what we define is, well, teams have to tell us how they test and how they release. Obviously, that's not something we can define for them. But as long as it's part of your continuous delivery, you supply a way where they can automate these things. Every single pull request we do inside of Azure runs unit testing automatically, and teams can define their code coverage levels. And as an organization, you may be able to actually go in and say, I require 80% of code coverage of these kinds of things. From the perspective of quality, it's very difficult to tell how something's going to work just from unit testing. But then you have to also go into integration testing. You have to go into early stages of deployment and canary deployments to actually tell what is the quality of this thing. It's very different depending on what team you're dealing with. And it's very important that you allow teams to define what that is and give them the right entry point to do so. We have this analogy with our pipeline where we're building this 8-lane freeway, and it's about getting every team to do 60 miles an hour and to make this happy path really good. We supply tools to do unit testing and validation. If they want to do their own thing, we supply an off-ramp where they can do their own thing, test their own way, and then there's an on-ramp back into our system where they can go forward. But it is highly dependent on the type of product.
I got one as well.
Tony, wait, I have to stop you. We are at time. I need to say, please remember your eval. I think we will all be happy to keep going, but we need to respect your time. If you want to step out, that's great. If you want to swarm us, that's great too.
Yeah, can we put our contact
Thank you all.
Yeah, oh yes, absolutely. Thanks.